This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وَمَا كَانَ قَوْلَهُمْ إِلَّا أَنْ قَالُوا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا وَثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَنَا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا رَبَّنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا وَثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَنَا وَانصُرْنَا عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الْكَافِرِينَ فَآتَاهُمُ ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio coming to you from Tehran. I'm Asma, your host for the next hour. We start with our news bulletin. That will be followed by The Ocean of Dua. The program explains supplications and prayers taken from various books such as Mafatih al-Jinan and Kamil al-Ziyarat. Our Varied Radio Productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for the next hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top headlines. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps strongly condemns Israel's assassination of a senior Hezbollah commander, calling it a proof to the regime's weakness and desperation. Afghanistan says at least 9 children and a woman have been killed in attacks by Pakistani forces in the Khost province. And finally, a new survey in the U.S. shows that the majority of Latinos reject Trump's approach to immigration and are dissatisfied with how they are treated in the country. Hello and welcome, everyone. Your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has issued a statement strongly condemning Israel's savage assassination of senior Hezbollah commander Haitham Ali al-Tabatai. The IRGC stressed that the regime's cowardly terrorist act during the so-called ceasefire is not a sign of strength, but proof to its weakness and desperation. The statement expressed deep regret over the silence and inaction of international and human rights institutions on Israel's genocide and savage actions, and Washington's support for the regime. It emphasized that, contrary to what the U.S., Israel, and their criminal allies dream of, the resistance remains alive and dynamic. The IRGC stressed that the resistance axis and Hezbollah reserve the right to avenge their fighters and commanders in due time with a crushing response that the terrorist aggressor regime will not expect. Iran's top security official has praised the country's ties with neighboring Pakistan, saying the relations can help promote regional peace and stability. Ali Larajani made the remark upon arriving in Islamabad for a 2-day visit. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council described Pakistan as an important country with an exceptional role in regional security. He also hailed as profound and deep the cultural ties between the two neighbors. Larajani is scheduled to meet with senior Pakistani military and political officials. Prior to his departure from Tehran, he lauded Pakistan for standing with the Iranian nation during the 12-day imposed war on Iran back in June. The Hamas resistance movement has called on international courts to prosecute those behind the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation for committing crimes against the Palestinian people. Hamas made the call after the American organization announced the end of its operations in Gaza. Hamas said the GHF contributed to the daily massacres of starving Palestinians and those seeking aid. It added that the foundation and those responsible for it must be held accountable for their crimes to prevent the recurrence of such tragedies and protect humanity from organized international terrorism. The movement asserted that since its entry into Gaza, the foundation acted as part of the occupying regime's security apparatus. It said the GHF used aid distribution methods that had no relation to humanitarian work and created degrading conditions for civilians trying to access food. Hamas stressed that the foundation's methods resulted in thousands of deaths and injuries due to the sniper fire and deliberate killings, making it complicit in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Historian and investigative journalist Tony Gossing joined us earlier to share his insights on the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and its complicity in the Gaza genocide.
At last, we see the back of this foundation. I think it's interesting that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation uses this kind of charitable status, as many other organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation the Carnegie Foundation. These people are very much like what we have in the UK, trusts. And the idea is that they're a charitable organisation. They're not for profit. But in this case, they're for killing. I'd just like to point out that there are 2,600 dead and injured people who were trying to access the Gaza so-called Humanitarian Foundation's facilities, which had been forced to take over because the Israelis, the Americans and the British and everybody else supporting the genocide was preventing UNRWA from doing their job, the United Nations, that is. And so, thankfully, this organisation is no more. One of their leaders, John Acri, I noticed, he was saying that what a wonderful job we did. He denied that any had been killed, so 2,600 dead and injured. He just was looking the other way. He didn't notice it. And actually, there were snipers, as you said, were actually killing people as they came towards the aid. So it was almost like a killing trap that you might set for a rat or an animal. That's what the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was, and so it's good to see the back of it.
Well, Palestinian towns and refugee camps in the occupied West Bank witness more deaths and destruction as Israeli forces press ahead with their deadly raids. In one of the latest incidents, a Palestinian young man was killed in an attack by the regime's forces in Nablus. The new fatality came after earlier in the day, a Palestinian youth was killed after being shot by Israeli forces in a raid on the village of Deir Jarir, northeast of Ramallah. Another Palestinian young man from the city of Doura, south of Al-Khalil, was also killed after being brutally beaten by the regime's forces. Israeli forces also raided the towns of Anin and Mithalon, west and south of Jenin, respectively. According to local sources, Israeli forces attacked Anin, deployed troops on its streets, abducted several young men, and confiscated surveillance cameras from several commercial shops. Our West Bank correspondent Akat Hamed joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory. This is what she had to say.
Unfortunately, it's going to be a long night for both Nablus and Jenin cities as the Israeli forces are making incursions to both of the cities now at this moment. Let's start from Nablus, where a prior incursion was made by the Israeli forces towards Nablus city. The special forces, Al-Yamam battalion, have infiltrated into Nablus city, attacking a Palestinian. Until now, there is no confirmation from a Palestinian source, nor did the Israeli sources have announced the name of that young man. In the western area, another home was besieged by the Israeli forces, which means that the IOF besieged Nablus from the eastern side and from the western side, performing a military operation inside Nablus. In the western side, arrests have been made from which are Mohammed al-Shafi and Samer al-Sidda. Samer al-Sidda is a liberated Palestinian prisoner, and he was re-detained tonight, and the PRCF announced that there has been an injury during this raid beside the Palestinian who was killed, which, by the way, the PRCS was banned from reaching to the site of this assassination.
Well, Israel has intensified its settlement expansion activities in the occupied West Bank town of Beit Omar in recent days. As a result, more land has been bulldozed and Palestinian farmers' access to their farmland has been restricted. Palestinians say these measures are part of a broader effort to push them out of their homes. Our correspondent Tiba Alse reports.
Bulldozers have leveled large areas of land in the town of Beit Omar near Al-Khalil over the past days. The activity is said to be part of efforts to expand the Karmit Sur settlement from the western side. At the same time, expansion work is also progressing from the eastern side toward the Gosh Etzion settlement. The activities have left Beit Omer trapped between the two settlement areas.
Beit Omer in the northern district of Al-Khalil has long been a center of Palestinian resistance. The town faces repeated land confiscations, military raids, and strict restrictions on farmland, forcing residents to struggle daily to protect their homes, land, and livelihoods.
Abu Maria rejected the Israeli claim of security reasons for its actions in Beit Omer, seeing it as a pretext to justify settlement expansion. Farmers have been particularly affected. Israel has designated their farmland as closed military zones, uprooting trees and restricting access to surrounding areas.
What's happening here has deeply affected us. I've been farming this land for many years, and now the Israeli regime is bulldozing and damaging parts of it without any real reason. They claim it's for security, but that's not true. The goal is clear: expanding settlements at the expense of our land.
These lands are a source of livelihood for many families here. Blocking Palestinians from accessing them has nothing to do with security. It's a way to take over the area and push people out.
In addition to settlement expansion, Palestinians' livelihoods in the occupied West Bank are also threatened by settler attacks. Such incidents have increased in recent years, with many blaming Israeli officials for turning a blind eye to the violence.
As Israeli forces keep bulldozing and leveling Palestinian infrastructure and land, residents here say this is part of the regime's wider plot, not only to seize more land, but also to escalate settler violence in the area, piling up pressure on the local community and restricting their access to what remains of their farmland. Tiba Asi, Occupied West Bank.
In other news, Press TV has officially launched its Hebrew language and news service in order to expand its reach to Hebrew-speaking audiences worldwide. A dedicated website for the service is expected to be launched soon to provide audiences with direct access to the relevant content. It will deliver a mix of news, analysis, and commentaries, covering both regional and international developments. The service has already gone live on X social media platform. A Telegram channel has also been launched to offer followers another outlet to receive updates. The move followed a directive issued by Iran's Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution in early November. It tasked the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting with establishing an international television network in Hebrew. According to Article 2 of the directive, the project is intended to strengthen Iran's media diplomacy, counter hostile narratives, and provide a more accurate account of regional developments. In Tehran, a vast funeral procession has carried the remains of 100 unknown soldiers from Iran's 8-year sacred defense to their final resting place. Coinciding with the martyrdom anniversary of Sayyida Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Gisumi Shahmadi reports.
The streets of Tehran turning into rivers of remembrance. Coffins draped in flowers and the Iranian tricolor moving slowly from the main gate of Tehran University along major avenues towards the martyrs' memorial. Thousands lining the route, reciting prayers and chanting tributes for the fallen. The ceremony marking National Day of Unknown Soldiers honors fighters whose remains were recovered decades after the Iraqi-imposed war. Their sacrifice, officials say, remains the backbone of Iran's security.
You should not think they have died. According to Islamic teaching, they are alive with God. We are here to let these unknown soldiers know we remember them and are grateful for their sacrifice.
Among the crowd are veterans, families of martyrs, school children, and young volunteers, generations connected through shared memory and devotion to their homeland.
They sacrificed their lives for our homeland. That is the ultimate act of faith and love for the nation.
The unity of the people is what the martyrs expect from us, not distraction or division.
We are just like their families. We are here for them. I lost my own family, all martyred in the war, so I feel like a sister, a mother, to these unknown martyrs.
While huge crowds escort 100 martyrs to their final resting place, even more have converged on Imam Hussein Square for a special ritual marking the martyrdom anniversary of Lady Fatima Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet of Islam. Here, massive cauldrons of samanu, a sweet paste made from wheat germ, are stirred in turn by volunteers. This is more than a religious ritual. It is an act that fosters empathy and solidarity.
Everyone you see here has come out of love for our beloved lady. Honoring martyrs is rooted in our culture, a tradition that never fades.
Two scenes, one spirit. Iran's culture of remembrance, transforming grief into faith. From Samanu offerings in Imam Hussein Square to salutes before the coffins of the unknown soldiers.
As Iranians bid farewell to these unknown martyrs, the participants say the sacrifice of these fallen soldiers is the foundation of Iran's unity, resilience, and security. Yusuf Shahmadi, Tehran.
The Taliban-led government in Afghanistan says Pakistani airstrikes have killed at least 9 children and a woman in the Khost-Ri province. The Taliban spokesman said attacks were also carried out in the provinces of Kunar and Paktika, leaving 4 civilians injured. Islamabad has yet to comment on the strikes. The strikes came just a day after twin suicide bombings in Pakistan's Peshawar killed 3 paramilitary personnel. Tensions between the two neighbors have been escalating since October. A ceasefire was signed in Doha last month, but peace talks in Turkey collapsed soon after, with both sides failing to reach agreement over militant groups operating inside Afghanistan. A new survey in the U.S. shows rising pessimism among Latinos under the Trump administration. The Pew Research Center says 70% of Latinos disapprove of the way Trump is handling his job as president. Over 2/3 of them are also critical of the administration's approach to immigration. According to a separate survey conducted by Axios Ipsos, some 65% of respondents say it's a bad time to be Latino or Hispanic in the U.S. Since Trump came to office in his second term, Trump's crackdown against immigrants has worsened. Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
Tonight, a tiny angel sleeps on my knees. She's only 5 years old, but her heart's bigger than the seas. Tonight, our house is filled with the sound of the angel's wings. She has so many more friends in the skies than on the earth. Oh, my daughter, you're my soul, you're my calm in the storm. All my dreams will come true 'cause of you. You are a part of me and the light of my eyes. It's you, my longing for heaven, I breathe in your scent anew. You shine like the moon and the stars revolve around you. You dream of a holy sun rising and this dead world starting to bloom. Oh, my daughter, you're my soul, you're my calm in the storm. All my dreams will come true 'cause of you. Longing for heaven, I breathe in your scent. softly kiss your cheek. You are the fire of me and the light of my eyes. It's you, the longing for heaven I breathe in, your scent I know. You're a fire of me and the light of my eyes. It's you, the longing for heaven I breathe in, your scent I know.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of Iftitah supplication, and we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Alhamdulillah, الذي لا يهتك حجابه ولا يغلق بابه ولا يرد سائله ولا يخيب آمنه.
Praise be to Allah. No one can disclose anything hidden by him, and no one can shut the doors kept open by him, and no one who makes a request is sent away disappointed by him.
We concluded in the previous program that we have got to have presence of heart while we try to worship, while we try to have connections with the Almighty Allah, the creator of us. And we are bound to discharge our duty in the best possible manner, but of course commensurate to our knowledge. Although we must strive to perform better and be more polite and humble in the presence of God the Exalted. But of course we should also note that the prayer which is devoid of understanding is not completely useless. And we should do our duty along with asking and beseeching God to give us presence of heart and the opportunity to increase our understanding. Anyway, many subjects mentioned in the supplications and prayers are about the knowledge of God. If the love of God is deeply rooted in the heart of man, he will himself be concerned with the performance of worship. As such, whenever the loving servants of Allah have the opportunity to talk to him, be it short period of time, they think of prayer. They think about the remembrance of God and they think about supplication. Of course, we have warned before that it is inappropriate to imagine that since we are always worshipping God in the form of prayer and supplication, we have that merit to be good servants for Him. We are fooling ourselves with such assumptions. If a person really loves another, he does not want to separate from her, even for a second. Imam Hussein alayhi salam has said, Ilahi amarta bir ruju'i ila al-athar. O Allah, in order to know you, you have commanded us to refer to the effects of your power. It is true that God has commanded it, but his loving servants' desire is to be always close to him. They want to be always in his presence, even if they are obliged to pay attention to material means. And maybe outwardly, their hearts seem to be detached from his remembrance. So, let me ask you this question. Does the one who doesn't want to spend an hour in litany and supplication have any love for God? Can it be said that our love and hate, struggle and other feelings are just for the sake of God without really loving him? If our actions are indeed for his sake, it is never possible not to love him and consider something more desirable than prayer. The awliya of Allah, those divine men of Allah, are always waiting for the slightest opportunity to supplicate in a corner. They try to perform their social responsibilities, and then they would schedule themselves in order to hear the divine invitation in their supplications and litanies, and that would give them more energy and enthusiasm for the continuation of their lives, since they know they're disconnected from the beloved. So talking to him, having that cord of prayer and worship, will give them more energy. Ilahi, كم تتحبب إلينا بالنعم وأنت عنا غني ونتبغض إليك بالمعاصي وإنا إليك محتاجون. Oh God, you love us and we can see that from all your blessings and your favors, though you are not in need of us. But we bring your wrath with our sinful acts, yet we are definitely in need of you.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it, and whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which he has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Anyway, dear listeners, we were talking about this part of the supplication. Alhamdulillahi alladhi la yuhtaku hijabuh. Praise be to Allah, none can disclose anything hidden by him. Wala yughlaqu babuh. No one can shut the doors kept open by him. Wala yuraddu sa'iluh. And no one who makes a request is sent away disappointed by him. Wala yukhayyabu amiluh. And no one who looks long and attentively is deluded in his hopes. Dear listeners, among the points highlighted in Dua al-Iftitah is that God never rejects his servants, as this part says, وَلَا يُغْلَقُ بَابُهُ وَلَا يُرَدُّ سَائِلُهُ. So God never closes his doors of mercy on the servants, or never allows the servants to lose hope, provided that they rely on Allah and pin their hopes on God. So we're going to talk about a bit about hope and reliance on God based on this part of the supplication, inshallah, in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Ghazmi. And in this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism, and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. Today, it's a privilege to be joined by Sarah Wilkinson. Sarah is a British independent journalist and a long-standing campaigner for Palestinian liberation. She began her professional career as a graphic designer and illustrator before transitioning into the world of journalism, where she's become known as one of the few Western voices providing unfiltered coverage of the situation on the ground in Palestine. Because of that, Sarah has been targeted by the Israel lobby, and in August 2024, she became the latest British journalist to be targeted for arrest. Her house was raided by the police and she was arrested under the Terrorism Act. She had her devices seized and was denied vital medication while in custody. And since then, she's been living under strict bail conditions that effectively aim to gag her work. Although she was able to join the recent global Samud flotilla that aimed to break the blockade on Gaza before being arrested again upon her return to Britain. She currently awaits trial for terrorism charges that have been brought against her, which is scheduled to take place in January 2027. But despite the onslaught she faces, Sarah refuses to be silenced, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the show today. So Sarah, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Sarah, let's just start by looking at your story, because while you're a very important independent journalist now, in a previous life, you were doing something a bit different in graphic design and illustration. So how did you become a journalist, and what drew you to focus so deeply or more deeply on Palestine?
Oh, there's sort of two questions there. I mean, although I was a graphic designer, I was working with a newspaper, which was pretty much pro-Palestinian. So my interest, if you like, in Palestine sort of like moved across, because it was already there. It was already there in the newspaper. So we ran a lot of pro-Palestinian stories in the early days. Some of them seem quite remote. I mean, we were covering the Ramallah tortoise, for instance, which not many people know about, the Palestinian indigenous tortoise that is being wiped out by the bulldozing of homes. So we were covering stories like that, water, conservation and things like that. But my interest in Palestine began years before that, when I discovered a leaflet in a library with a picture of a little boy facing into the barrel of an Israeli soldier's gun. And I couldn't understand it. I think he was about 10 years old. I think I was about 10 as well. So, you know, I took the leaflet because this is the reference library. So I did take the leaflet with me and I read it and I didn't fully understand it. So that led to me then trying to understand what was going on there. How could a child the same age of me have so much courage that he could stare into the gun of an Israeli soldier, and why? And so, you know, the research in those days was quite difficult. A lot of the books that were in the Central Library were all about tourism. They didn't explain the Nakba. A lot of it was from the Israeli narrative. So it wasn't until I really got to college and I was introduced to other pro-Palestinian people that it really began. I went to Greenham Common. That was one of my first protests. So I started learning about how protest works, why it's important, what happens when you get arrested, why people are being arrested. And it started to make the whole Palestinian issue make sense. So I was talking to people who knew more than me, who understood it from a political standpoint, which is that was the thing that was missing in those days. So when you've done something for so long, when you've read about something for so long, it becomes intertwined in your, I suppose, in your blood. I'm not quite sure whether the Palestinians would want me to say that I have Palestinian blood, but it becomes entwined with you yourself. Everything that you do revolves around Palestine, and you grow up revolving around that research. And so then you start to meet people and have pen friends, because it was before the days of Facebook and before the days of Twitter, certainly. So the Palestinians that I was talking to, I was doing so by letter. And I was being introduced to more and more people, families with young children. And then Facebook came along, and suddenly I could actually see who these people were in real time. And I was able to talk to them. I was able to listen to their stories. So the connection was already there. And also, I will say, and I'll try not to make it sound horrible, but I also witnessed them being killed. So this was the first time, and it was many years ago, my pen friends hiding under their kitchen table were bombed, 2012, I think. And only the mother survived. Her six children were killed. And she talked about having to make the choice of whether she saved the baby or she saved her mother, because both were on the top floor of the building. And she saved her mother and was racked with this enormous guilt that the baby had died. But then even her mother also didn't survive. So she was the only remaining person. So those were my original pen friends. So that was the beginning. That was the introduction to, I have to do something here. I cannot help this woman. I am geographically miles apart from her, but I have to do more than just read. I have to do more than just wave a flag and wear a t-shirt. I have to actually become more proactive. I have to save the next family. I have to do something. And also learning to live with the shock of losing my first pen friends, I suppose. They were my first loss. And from then on, I have lost many. It's never got easier, but they were my first greatest loss. And so there's always a place in your heart for people that are your friends, and then you want to find out why they died, what happened, what can you do to solve the situation. So you become much more politically involved, and you start protesting properly, and you start understanding the story properly, and you start reading about the politics properly. So yeah, it grew, it expanded, if you like. Much the same as the Greater Israel Project. But yeah, that's how it was for me.
Well, I mean, the Palestinian cause has the capacity to awaken the moral consciences of people. I think what you outlined will certainly resonate with a lot of people. I mean, certainly for me, it was a case of, as you say, you sort of have this knowledge, or you once you encounter the Palestinian question, you instinctively start to understand that this is an oppressive situation that should be overcome, that Palestinian liberation is something that's right and should be fought for. But then there's that gap between knowing something and then working out, well, what is your role in that process of liberation? But as we know, you know, walking on this path for the liberation of Palestine often comes at personal sacrifice. We know that the sacrifices that we endure here in the West are trivial compared to what Palestinians face. But in terms of campaigning here in the West, you can face quite severe consequences, not death necessarily, but your case is a case in point. I mean, the strength of the animus against you from the Israel lobby is no doubt motivated by how effective you've been at reporting on Palestine. So let's just get into that. I mean, in August 2024, your house was raided, you were arrested and subjected to quite fierce repression. Now, walk us through what happened to you on that day and sort of the immediate period afterwards.
Yeah, it should be included, actually, before I start on that, that, you know, when we began campaigning for Palestine, we did not know that the repression or the oppression was this is how it was going to be. We didn't know that we were going to be targeted or that we would be arrested. There was no indication that suddenly it was going to be criminalized. So, yeah, in August, I was woken up about 10 past 7 by 16 balaclavaed, I have to call them thugs, when there were some uniformed police trailing behind. But what you see come into your house is plain clothes. You can see black vans. The top end of town is closed off. The locals are terrorized because they don't know what's happening. They think it's some sort of gun raid. Some said they didn't know whether they should run away, duck, or film it. They actually didn't really know what it was. And they're in your house. They say they have a warrant, but they're not going to reveal it to you. So they're in your house before you have a chance, really, to know that you should actually be shutting your door at this point and demanding a warrant. They're in already. I mean, there isn't the time. And you're pushed against the wall. My son was pushed up against the wall. My house was absolutely ransacked. They were very clever. You know, they filmed it looking as if it was okay. And then most of the damage was probably done after they turned the cameras off. They hid things in places. They looted. They took things. They didn't list items. My son was thrown out of the house. I mean, he's just in his boxer shorts. So, he then rang his dad, who came to support him and obviously probably bring some clothes as well. And, you know, they tore the house apart. And in doing so, you know, my mother's ashes were scattered all over. I live, my bedroom's actually an attic room, so it's spread all over the attic. And we still haven't managed to recoup all of her remains. There's a quarter of her remains missing. And to have to use a dustpan and brush to sweep up your mother's remains, that's going to stay with me for a long time. That was quite hideous. The fact that, you know, they didn't really care how much damage they caused. I mean, clothes, underwear, everything pulled out everywhere. And then they made some attempt to shove things back in the wrong drawer or the wrong wardrobe. And then, of course, as soon as they left, everything fell out on the floor anyway. So it's an absolute hideous mess. But items like my passport, these things weren't listed on, these are the items we've taken from your house list. So when they asked my son to sign that everything was in order, he just wanted them to go. They'd been there for hours. I think this was like 5 o'clock. He just wanted them to go. My son doesn't really know where my passport is or where I've kept cash or where some of my, you know, jewellery is. He doesn't know really what's missing. And why would he? Because he doesn't live here. He's just a guest. So, he signed it mainly to get rid of them. But because he signed the form, it is now very difficult to actually try and get any of these items back. I'm certainly not going to get my electronic devices back. They took other people's devices as well. They weren't all mine. And then wanted PIN numbers for devices that I don't own. So they took an awful lot of stuff, probably about £7,000 worth of equipment if you add the mics and the headphones and you know, charger cables. And in fact, all of the cables, I've got lights on the stairs. Why do you need those cables? They're like one of those old fittings that you can never buy the cables for anymore. So it's just very malicious that like little items were taken, which kind of disabled the house from working properly. Bank cards missing, cash was taken, you know, everything that really decimated the house. And I don't know if they know what they were looking for. I think they were just looking for anything that they could pin on me. So there was this randomness about it. I don't, you know, they didn't find anything really. What they wanted was the devices. So they probably didn't need to destroy the house in the process. And it took us 7 days to put the house back together again, which is a long time. So,
well, I mean, what you've had to face is absolutely astounding and disgraceful and just so needless. And also, it's, as you said, it's sort of malicious and gratuitous, even the extent to which they have, you know, in the course of conducting this raid, damaged your house and, as you say, you know, scattered your mother's ashes, and it's really, really appalling. And also the effect, of course, then on, you know, someone like your son, completely, not that you're not innocent, but, you know, completely sort of a third party to the whole situation, has then been caught up in it, and absolutely no regard for him or his welfare. So it's just absolutely appalling. But of course, you know, you're one of many others who have been targeted. Perhaps the others haven't been targeted in quite the horrific way that you were, but we've seen Asa Winstanley, Richard Medhurst, Kit Clarenberg, others targeted. And that's just when we're talking about journalists, but we've also seen increasing crackdowns against activists, protesters, commentators, using brutal policing methods like you just outlined, and also quite intimidatory prosecutions. I mean, the situation is becoming quite severe now, isn't it?
It is, and what it is terrorism. It's terrorism against civilians, activists, reporters, doctors, teachers. And the elderly holding up placards. And I think there's been over 2,000 people arrested, and some of them very brutally. And every home raid has been a little bit different. It's like you'd almost think that there wasn't a pattern. I think there is a pattern because there isn't a pattern. I think they're pushing out the boundaries. They're finding out how far they can go, who's going to take them to court, whether anybody's going to make an official complaint. You know, they're sort of testing the waters. So every home raid and every arrest has been a bit different. I've heard stories of an elderly woman left out in the snow in her nightgown for hours in bare feet while they searched her house and didn't allow her back in. So no compassion or even police protocol for, you know, taking people's age or their ability into account. So we've seen very young people being arrested very violently. So this almost is very close to sort of child abuse, when somebody very, very young, by 30 and 40 year old police officers who are balaclavaed in much the same way, treating people with utter brutality. It's very, very close. And so there is no, well, it's done with total disregard for age, gender, ability, and celebrity status, if you like. It doesn't really matter. So it's an act of terrorism against us as civilians and against activists. And it's done. This is the irony. It's done in the name of countering terror, of anti-terror. It's done in the name of combating crime. And certainly isn't combating crime arresting people that are innocent and have never committed any crimes. So, you know, when you're arresting an elderly person for holding up a placard, it's completely and utterly needless. And I think it is. It's British state terror. But they're using these anti-terror laws to commit this terrorism. And that is the irony of it, is these aren't terrorists. And these aren't people that would probably ever be, you know, ever do anything wrong. Well, they're very law-abiding citizens, if you like. So You know, if they were actually going after people that were making threats, that were making, you know, threats of life against other people, then that would be one thing. But these are just ordinary folk, or they're ordinary students who've never been arrested before, or they're teachers, parents. You know, how long before they start arresting young children? Well, they probably are under prevent. So, you know, it is terrorism, and they are using the anti-terror laws to commit their acts of terrorism. The irony is just astonishing, really.
Well, I mean, I wanted to actually consider this in a bit more detail, as you say, this sort of weaponization of anti-terror laws. I actually got into a discussion in some detail with the previous guest of mine, who's quite well known, the barrister Frank McGuinness, obviously you're someone who's had this direct experience of these laws, which many would argue, and I certainly would argue, have been weaponized against you and others. You know, the whole modern concept of so-called terrorism, I think, has always been very problematic. But it seems to be the case now that terrorism, more blatantly than ever, just means behavior that the state doesn't like. And I think that has really increased, in particular, over the last sort of year or two. But surely that can't be sustainable. I mean, would you say that British society is going to reach breaking point over this? And how far do you think the government can really go in terms of continuously expanding this notion of terrorism and applying it against ordinary people?
I don't know how far it will go. And I don't know what the intention of it. I know that there is, well, when you're talking with young people, you know, people who say, oh, I'd never ring 999 anymore. I'd ring for a taxi to come and help me, but I'd never ring the police. I boycott Crime Stoppers. I don't have anything to do with the police any longer. Even very conservative, if you like, people that have been burgled, they've lost an awful lot of money. They own large properties. And the police have turned up sort of 4 weeks after the 999 call and said, we can't be bothered. Just go through your insurance. So what concerns me, I guess, and I know that nobody likes Douglas Murray, and I do get that, but he was the one that did a bit of research and found out that the police hadn't actually solved any crime or burglary crime in the north for over a year. And it's purely because what they're doing is arresting people who aren't criminals. They're arresting people for voicing their opinion about the Israeli genocide. Anyone that supports Palestine, anyone that supports Gaza, anyone that knows anybody in Palestine, or anybody reporting the news, or, you know, who's got a public platform, they now are the ones who are criminalized. So on meeting a burglar in a pub a few months back, he actually said, it's my most lucrative time. I can now burgle houses and the police don't give a damn. Now, there's a truth in that. They don't have time for crime any longer, but what they do have time for is protecting the Israeli state and protecting the Israeli genocide and protecting the government's very deep-rooted complicity in the genocide. So that's all they're working for now. They're just working to protect the Israeli regime. So everything else now, like I say, you make a 999 call. It'll take them 4 weeks to arrive, certainly in our area. And then if you're lucky, you'll get a text message saying, sorry, you've been a victim of crime. Then you'll never hear anything ever again. So I don't actually know where the police think that they're going on this. They're certainly turning the hearts and minds of people that have probably been quite supportive of the police away. They're stopping, young children don't want to ring 99 anymore. Parents aren't telling the kids to ring 99 in case the kids get taken away. There's this sort of fear, terror, that the police now are no longer working for us, but they're working for the Israeli regime. And they're doing it through the government, the British government, which is now so tightly melted in to the regime that they're facilitating the genocide. They're selling them weapons. We're even hosting the Israeli weapons factories. We are trading like never before. Yeah, they made that 30%. They cut out 30% of the arms that they were sending to over to Israel, but it's probably a few wires and a few soundboards and a few things like this. But the majority of the drones are made here, the majority of the fleet. We're still making helicopter parts, Merkava tank, air conditioning parts. We're still trading with the Israelis to make sure that this genocide can continue. We're still sending them weapons. So, we've got to a stage where our government's no longer working for us. The police aren't working for us. I'm concerned that the judicial system is not working for us as well. I don't know what will happen with these 2,000 people. Will they just acquit them? Will they drop the charges? Will they continue to harass them? Will there be more home raids? This is fascism. And it's crept into our lives without us really noticing, to the point now where, you know, you have to lock your door every time you go out. You have to have a double lock on your door now when you go out. You know, you have to hide your devices. You have to turn things off. You have to make sure your PIN numbers are changed. You have to make sure everything is encrypted. It's like we've become paranoid of people that used to once serve us or used to once protect the communities. They no longer do that. They're becoming our enemies. And I don't know where that leads. I don't know what the pushback will be, but there will be one. There will be one.
Well, thank you very much for that, Sarah. I'm afraid that we have run out of time for part one of the program, so we're going to have to pause our conversation there. But we'll be back with part two of Attrition before too long. See you next time.
You are listening to Iran Radio and Straightly. We go to the interesting facts about Islam. During the Golden Age of Islam, Muslims created a house of wisdom, or Baitul Hikmah, which was active during the 9th and 13th century, where both Muslims and non-Muslims scholars sought to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that might have otherwise been lost were preserved in Arabic and Persian, and later translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin.